before you do anything. Finish this sentence. This is a success if. Time kills startups. So, and the difference between trying to push your way through in a crowded market, even if you're doing reasonably well, and having an entire like lane to yourself, it's night and day.
Welcome back to the Breakout CEO Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Holman. And today I've got Andrew Ackerman with me. Andrew's lived what I think might be the full arc of entrepreneurship, scaling a company, leading another company that maybe didn't work out as well, and then spending a lot of time investing, advising, accelerating other companies. I'm really excited to have this interview today. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's exciting to hear and see people who've done a depth of different experiences. Do you have a theme to this arc that you've been on? And maybe you didn't have it up front, but looking back, are there any overriding themes to what you've been doing?
Yeah, you know, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
No, so I love that.
I'm in awe of people who, or at least it looks like they called their shot from the beginning. Like, I was going to do this, that, and the other thing, especially when it was like sort of different bases to get around to where they wanted to be. And I was wondering to myself, like, did they really plan that from the beginning? Or did it just kind of come together nicely for what they want to do? And in my case, it's definitely been in that other category. And when I started out, there's no, like, this whole startup scene didn't really exist. So I was a consultant for 4 years. But I actually got some really interesting skills out of that. And then when all of a sudden, like, the startup thing's for real, right? And then the boom is happening. And I get into my first startup and I do that for 8 years. That's awesome. And when I'm coming out of that, I end up in a family office. So I'm kind of on that side of the table. And that was an interesting experience. I did my second startup, which, as you alluded to, well, experience is what you get when you didn't get what you wanted. That was an awesome experience. No. And then I ended up doing more and more investing. So then I shift over to another part of the table as an angel and then ultimately as an accelerator and a VC. So when I look back and I'm like, oh, wow, the stuff I got in consulting really helped me with dealing with the corporate customers that I wanted to get for my startups. And then it helps me understand why a corporate venture fund works or doesn't work. Like, yeah, it all adds up. You know, the temptation is to say, yeah, I purposely did that. I wanted all those building blocks, where the truth is like, no, there was kind of a step level progression with a little bit of luck, a little bit of interest. And now the things I can do are the sum of those experiences. But I'd be lying if I said that, like, this is the plan all along.
Totally fair. And I can relate to that myself with my own journey. You know, if you asked me when I was 15 or 16, what do you want to be when I grow up? My answer was simple. I want to be rich. I had no plan to get there, you know, and I've done fine for myself. But I think life and the journey happens to you. And while there's a certain skill that allows some people to dictate and follow that path really easily, I think there's a certain skill to flowing with the path as it develops too. And you know, that's worked for me. And I think it sounds like it's worked very well for you too,
to be able to draw
from all of that. So, well, so if you look back at this experience as it unfolded, what are the two or three highlights that maybe carry the most weight for you for where you're at today? That maybe the things you've pulled to aggregate into the skill set you have?
That's a good one. There are a couple of moments along the way where I learned things, and sometimes how formative they would be wasn't clear to me at the time. So during my first startup, and we're really early, this is a company called Bunk One. We're doing internet services for summer camps, you know, password-protected photo galleries, one-way email systems. You know, the kids don't have to be anywhere near their computer. It's printed out and given to them. I know it seems pretty basic, but in 2000, that was a big deal. I just come out of consulting and like I'm having a little bit of trouble with one of the salespeople because every deal he has is different. It's like $9.95 for this guy. It's $9.99 for that guy. $9.98, $10. I'm like, Ed, man, what the fuck? Pardon my language, but like, really? Like, can't we just all have the same? And it got to be a bit of friction. Like, you know, the spreadsheets were getting unwieldy. I couldn't like run any of the numbers. That's not strictly true. I could, but it was untidy. And so the CEO took me aside and says, Andrew, you don't get it, right? We're early in this whole journey together, Right now, we just need to say yes, right? A, we need the money. B, we need the customers to refer to so we can get more of them. But more importantly, like, we need to get as many customers on so we can learn from them, so we can understand like what they really need, so we can make our product better, make new products. So right now we're just saying yes. And maybe when we 10X the revenue, then like the complexity is a problem. So go in there and clean it up. But like for now, the number one thing we need to do is make it possible to say yes.
Customer feedback.
My mentality kind of flipped, right? That's like, I get it now. Startups are messy. They're supposed to be messy. They're supposed to let you learn from things you didn't think you would come across. And the time to like smooth it out is as you scale.
And were you able to, was Bunk One able to smooth it out, scale, figure out what the customers wanted?
Did that
turn out well?
We did about 2 or 3 years later, I don't remember, about 2 or 3 years later, we did a pricing rationalization project.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you got to the point where you were able to introduce some order to the chaos.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the second time where it was kind of formative, we were, and this was kind of one of the points we talked about earlier, about kind of those breakthrough moments when you're kind of at a plateau and like, you know, how do you get back up into like that strong into the right growth, up into the right growth? So I had been at Dreamit, which at the time was one of the top 5 early stage accelerator programs in the world. And for those people in your audience who aren't familiar with accelerators, it is the kind of investor that gets involved even before a venture capital fund does, when the startup is, you know, not quite fully baked. And it helps them get to the point where they can raise what's called their seed round, which is usually their first meaningfully large check.
So, and you're really stepping in to say, hey, maybe there's some money involved, but we have usually a core team that can fill some of the gaps and provide some of the, you know, the second time founder experience to the first time founder who's in the accelerator, right?
Absolutely. Like it's a very high touch experience. All the programs are a little bit different. The way we did it was we'd meet with the teams weekly, like go in depth every week for an hour or more. Where are they at? What are they going to do next? Deliverables for next week. And in parallel, we would bring in speakers on a bunch of different topics, you know, so it's like pizza's here, speakers here, sit down, learn. And at the end of that 12-week period, they'd be like, hey, get up in front of like a bunch of investors and pitch your heart out for money type deal. So that's the general outline of like an early stage accelerator. And that's what we were doing for like the first couple of years I was there. So it's about 2.5 years in. And we had this offsite with a new CEO. And the CEO's like, yeah, being top five is fine. But I really want to be number one. Yeah. Can we be number one at what we're doing? So kind of sad.
Who were you competing against at the time, just for context?
At the time, it's still, so Y Combinator is still number one. They were the first and the oldest one. They have a fantastic network. And I can quibble a little bit about like it's become a puppy mill and like a little bit of lemming, like, you know, investing process. But they still like, they built something awesome and it's true. And then, you know, arguably the next one, certainly at that time, was Techstars. They'd built a very large network of accelerators, many of whom or most of whom were funded by corporate partners. We tried doing that too. We had some, but like they were better at it than us, no doubt, hands down. So, you know, there were others out there, but those were kind of the big two. And we thought like maybe if we did everything right and we executed on everything just right, and maybe if Techstars stumbled a little, we might be able to overtake them. But Y Combinator was too far ahead. We just didn't think that was going to happen. Because it's a little bit like a virtuous cycle, like a marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
The best startups want to go where they're the most active investors. And the most active investors want to go where the best startups. And if that's Y Combinator, that's where they're going to go. It's like any marketplace. So, you know, we had this conversation at our offsite. And the CEO at the time, Abhi Sivar, a great guy, he's like, well, I don't want to be number two or number three. So what can we do where we can be number one? And just changing the way we thought about it from like, how can we like maybe move up in the ranks to like, what could we do where we're like, we're not butting up against these guys? Got us thinking, well, you know, we actually do have some interesting supply and demand dynamics of our own. We've got all these later stage for us, startups. So after their seed round, startups. And they're like, we really love the way you get startups, you know, introductions to potential corporate partners. But we're like beyond this stage. Is there anything we can do maybe a little different? And then on the flip side, we had a lot of the corporate partners that were saying, man, that's really interesting. Like, that's a great, interesting startup, painful problem, great team. I love what they're building. But they're just a little too early to work with a Fortune 500 company. So we're going to watch them for 6 months to a year. And like idiots, we kept bringing them, you know, early stage stuff. And they kept saying, that's awesome, but 6 months. But keep bringing us the cutting edge stuff.
Yeah, you're the accelerator. And they're saying, wait, slow down. Well, not accelerate, slow down.
Because they didn't even know it, right? They like, we want cutting edge, but we're not ready to do it. And they didn't really, it's almost like the dog chasing the, you know, the mailman. Like, and if you capture the, if you catch the truck, what are you going to do to it, right? They hadn't kind of thought that through. But then it dawned on us, wait, we have later stage startups who are 6 to 12 months further along. And we have the corporates that want to meet them. Let's make that market instead. We ended up saying, well, if we do that, like, you know, we can go a little later. There's nobody doing that. Number one, we're the only one. There's just two problems. One, we have to change the entire program. And B, we have to change the entire financial offer.
Like, yeah.
That's a how. Small, that's not a what. Small, we can do that.
Well, so, I want to back up though, because what you're explaining is, you know, it sounds like the initial goal was, hey, let's be number one, like categorically number one. And then the team said, well, wait a second, that might be a little bit difficult to do given the circumstances. Let's be more blue ocean, you know, number one in a way. Let's define where we can be number one, even if it's not across the board.
Let me give a slightly different analogy, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, imagine you're racing cars, right? I mean, F1 was out, I saw it not that long ago, right? So there's a bunch of cars in front of you. And like, you're jockeying for position. Can you pass them? You know, they got to make a little bit of a slip up and you got to get past them. But like, you know, it's really hard. Now, what we did instead was like, you know, F that track, we're going to go on this track. And there's nobody on that track. So there's no one we have to worry about getting in front of. There's no one blocking us. Like, we're out. And the difference between trying to push your way through in a crowded market, even if you're doing reasonably well, and having an entire like lane to yourself, it's night and day. But you got to start thinking about your business differently. You got to start thinking like, I'm, you know, this is what I am. But wait a second, I don't have to be that. What if I was this instead? And, you know, by challenging us the way he did, he got us thinking rather like, how can we get ahead of the next car to like, where can we find an entirely empty lane?
Which brings along with it the challenges like you mentioned. You have to start building the track or identifying the lane or maybe modifying your car so it drives on a different surface, whatever, right?
Good news is you have your own lane. The bad news is it's a river. Okay, so we'll build a boat instead, right?
Yeah. And who's the audience at the track and, you know, who are you catering to at that point?
New network of later stage investors, right? That was more important. We had to get rid of that demo day because like if you're trying to raise a Series A round, like you're trying to raise $5 or $10 million instead of like 2 or 3, right? It's a different type of investor, different type of raise. And there was a lot of changes we had to make. And without going into too many details, it was a lot of fun to do it. But the key is like, once you've figured out where that lane is, then it's execution. Like it's important, but you know, it's not as important as finding that lane.
Well, did this end up being an inflection point for Dream It?
Is
this,
oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Is this the transition from Dream It 1.0 to Dream It 2.0?
Yeah, no, absolutely it was. So we were, you know, we at the same time, one of the things we did is we went vertically focused. Because if you're going to hang your hat on biz dev, it's easier to do that for like, you know, 5 or 6 companies or 7 companies that are all in sort of the same industry. And they all have like the same group of maybe 3 potential, 4 potential types of customers. So we did that and we went from being like nothing in the spaces that we opened up to being the leader in that space virtually within, you know, a year or two. And it was very easy for us to capture attention because like when no one else is doing it, like, oh my God, they're the only ones doing this.
What did that do to your, I want to say audience again, but being more specific here, what did that do to the network you were in? Like, what did it look like before the transition? And then how was it? You were leading in the next one, but mm-hmm. what did that What was that change?
So let's talk about a couple of audiences, right? So we had the startup audience, mm-hmm. which these are, you know, they come into the program. Then we had the investors who hopefully would invest in the startups. Then we had the corporates who would hopefully do business with them. Let's just start with those three because there's a couple other smaller ones. But number one, I had to go after a different pool of startups, right? So I was recruiting initially generalist, earliest stage. You know, when you're just a couple of guys, you haven't raised any money, there's not a lot of digital footprints. So you got to do a very strong ground game. You got to go to events physically. You got to partner with groups that have, you know, like co-working spaces and the such.
What year was this, by the way? Because that changes.
Oh, so when I first came in, it was 2014, and we'd been doing that since 2008.
Okay.
So that was a tough ground game. But then you're starting to deal with startups that are a little further, you know, along. You can start doing things like, well, I'm going to go subscribe to Crunchbase or Mattermark. And I'm going to go figure out who's raised a seed round. Has it been, you know, 8 months, 10 months, 12 months since that seed round? They might be in our strike zone now. We can start using those as indicators, not 100%, because in the fields that we were in, there were a lot of people that kind of bootstrapped beyond it, but we could do that. And along that, we had a kind of another challenge, which was all of our startups, when they heard the word accelerator, the ones that we wanted to meet with, oh, we're beyond that stage. But that actually meant that they were at our stage. They just didn't know it because they thought
about accelerators differently.
So we had to change how we communicated it. Like, we didn't use the A word anymore. So the startup side changed. And then for the investors, like, instead of going after angel investors who like to invest a little bit more locally, I'm bringing them into a room. We're going after Series A investors, which are usually VC funds or corporate venture funds. They will often invest nationwide, sometimes internationally. But they have like their own special focus, foci, that a word? I don't know. Focus.
Yep, that's a word.
Okay, I'm going to go foci. They have their own foci. And you have to understand all of that. And a lot of general angels are kind of like, oh, show me a shiny toy. Let's see. So we had to develop a much more structured version of the list by geography. And we actually had to go with our startups. We call it a roadshow, right? We do the investor roadshow.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We go
with them.
With them, yeah.
Okay.
We had to be very
okay.
purposeful about that. And we were early adopters of Zoom pre-pandemic for the cities we didn't go to. So we had to build all that different network of investors, and we had to think about how we access them, right? They, you know, we had to plan ahead, you know, and demo day didn't work. So we threw it out and we came up with the investor roadshow instead.
How did this change how you're, like, the dynamics of your team? Because, you know, when you change the business model, necessarily, mm-hmm. team dynamics shift, roles change, functions change.
Absolutely. At the core level, right? You know, we used to be geographically focused. We changed to being industry focused or vertically focused. Okay, that's fine. I've done a lot of things in my career. I just span up an ed tech program. And then later I span up, you know, prop tech and construction tech. And it was fun kind of learning about it. But also now, instead of being like, okay, I'm running a program, then I'm going to, like, relax, do other things, and run another program. Instead of flexing up and down, it became much more of a year-round program. So I had a team with two other people in my vertical. And we had one that was more focused on program managing, and we had another that was focused on kind of the early stage prospecting. Like, let's find the list, let's get in touch with them, set up the meeting, make sure at the right stage, and then bring them to me. So we became a little bit more disciplined about that. Need, you know, slightly different skills. By the way, I'm one of those people that says, like, you know, people go out there and like, oh, A plus people only work with A plus people, right? Only hire A plus founders for your team. And I'm one of those people that says, yeah, of course, if you can, but, you know, resources aren't unlimited, right? So, you know, anyone can make an awesome hamburger from Kobe beef, but the whole idea of creating the hamburger is that you can take the less than perfect meat and still have a really good meal out of it. So, you know, the skill as a founder is understanding where you need to be awesome, right? Where you need to, you know, you and your co-founder have to have these two skills or two areas of expertise down. And then you need to be able to get the best effort out of everyone else just to keep things going and moving forward. So I think it's a myth that you can, like, recruit A players all. I mean, unless you're, you know, raising $50 million, like, pre-seed rounds, because I don't know, you're OpenAI. But I digress. So the team shifted a little bit. We had to specialize, we had to work at those processes. And then we also had, instead of being like a whole bunch of individual little fiefdoms by geography, we had to have people kind of more at the, for lack of a better word, corporate level or the central level, coordinating all the moving parts. So we would have a health vertical. We would have, you know, prop tech and construction tech vertical. We would have a secure tech vertical. And we would all have the investor roadshows at the same time. So we needed basically people that can run those events. Like, hey, because some of the investors are generalists, they'll look at everything, and some are industry specific. So it's like, okay, these 2 weeks we're on the road, we're going to be in the Bay Area these 4 days. You know, here is your list of 4 or 5 prop tech companies, or here's your list of 15 companies across all the sectors. So we had to build that those capabilities at our kind of corporate level.
Was there ever a moment where the team expressed, or maybe just acknowledged that, because it sounds like as you shifted your business model, you're building out functions to match the model. And in a sense, you're kind of doing the same things in a way that you're seeing your accelerator companies doing in their own businesses, right? You're building as they're building, so to speak. Was that apparent, or was that a factor in how you guys did things?
Well, that's what kept it exciting, right? Because, like, you know, we do something once, okay, it worked. We do it again to get better at it. And then the third time, like, you know, screw that. We're going to tear it up and do it totally differently. You know, it's a very startup-y way to do that. And, you know, I'll give everyone I worked with credit for eating their own dog food on that. No, it's a little different, right? We had different customers. We had different type of marketplace. But at the, like, the meta view, the highest view, right, you got to go out there. You got to get a list of prospects. You got to qualify them, right? You got to move them through the funnel. You got to close them, right? You got to think about that kind of systematically and objectively. You got to have that kind of framework about going into the world and into the market.
And you were, in a sense, testing product market fit with this new approach to see if it worked for the different audiences that you were working with. I kind of wonder, did it ever raise questions? Because I think when I relate this back to CEOs who are building a business and they're in this messy, muddy stage, right? And they're like, some days it's like, we're killing it. This is awesome. I think we've got it down. And the next day they're like, man, we really messed up. Like, I don't think this is going to work. What was I thinking? Like, was that ever present at the team level with you guys? Because it's what CEOs relate to in a way.
Yeah.
And it's hard to build a business without having some of that, right?
So I'm tempted to say, like, it was like that every other Tuesday. But actually, it wasn't. It was. Early on, it was. But it got a lot better. So let me kind of break that down for you. First-time founders and the early generations of accelerators, ourselves included, kind of make, many of us make a similar mistake, right? We see a problem in the market, and it's huge, right? We know it. I got it. Like, it's definitely big. Like, there's no denying that. And we come up with a solution. We go, I'll just build it and put it out there. And that's actually wrong in 2 or 3 different levels. So number one, even if we're convinced that it is a huge market and, like, it's a big problem, you got to get out there and talk to a lot of people. Because even if you're right that it is a huge market, going out and talking to all your potential customers, or if you have a marketplace like us, both sets of your customers, or all 3 sets of your customers, startups, you know, investors, corporates, you have to understand how they see the problem. Right? So number one, you'll validate there is a problem and that it's big. And number two, you'll also understand how they see the problem. So you understand how to design what you're building. So the other reason it was wrong, if you just went out there and built, like, you want to get that feedback before you build as much as possible so that you don't end up building stuff no one cares about, or you don't end up building it, like, in ways no one understands how to use it. So, you know, I talk about this in my book a lot with a couple of different analogies, like the index card app. All right, so let's say I wanted to build an app for, you know, for whatever. A lot of the first-time founders go in there like, okay, I know what I want to build. I'm going to go down, put my hoodie over, go into a dark room, and I'll just code for 4 months, and boom, here it is, world, enjoy it. And then they find out that, like, half of the features no one touches, the other ones no one knows how to use, and they go back and they fix it. For the cost of, like, a pack of 4x6 index cards, I don't know, it's like $5, and a pen, which, by the way, you can steal from your local bank. You don't have to pay for this because startups should be cheap. You go out there and you sketch on a bunch of the cards what each page in your website or your app looks like.
Okay.
True drawings, right? This is not just basic.
Not even Figma at this point.
Yeah. I mean, you could use, I use balsamic sometimes, but, and that mocks like the hand-drawn look to it. Mm-hmm. But you want to come up with all these pages, and then you go out there and you talk to 30 people, 20, 30, 40, 50 people who are your target customer. And you say, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. What I want to do is I want to put a mock-up of my app in your hands. What I want you to do is I want you to interact with it exactly the way you would interact with it if it were really on your phone right now. So like, if you want to swipe, swipe on the index card and I'll give you the next screen. Tap, swipe. If you're not sure, just, well, that's the one thing I want you to do differently. You can't ask me questions because I'm not going to be there when you download it. But just verbalize what you're thinking because I can't read your mind. It's like, oh, that's cool. Say that out loud. Or I have no idea what that button was and I'm afraid to push it because who knows. I just, you got to say that out loud. But otherwise, I'm just going to watch you and let them interact with it, give them the new screens. And then, you know, 20, 30 minutes later when they're like done, then you break character and you debrief. And you're like, hey, I noticed you didn't use any of these. You know, why not? It's like, well, I don't need that, right? Or, you know, I noticed you hesitated over here. What's the deal? And, you know, kind of debrief with them and get that. But if you do that for like 20, 30 or 40 potential customers, when you actually go out there and spec out your product and build it, it's going to be a lot smoother. You're not going to build the stuff no one wants. The stuff that people want, you'll build the way they want, the way they understand it. You won't miss anything. And that was, in essence, the difference between Dreamit 1.0. We were all just kind of figuring it out. We went out there, built it, iterated. Dreamit 2.0, where we spoke to a whole bunch of startups in the later stage. Like, would this make sense to you, right? We spoke to a whole bunch of the investors. We spoke to a lot of the potential customers. And we, you know, the right way, right? You know, the old saying, like if you ask somebody in the late 1800s, you know, what they want, they're like, oh, I want a faster buggy, right? They wouldn't think of the car. So you got to kind of get at those, you know, those ideas. But we spoke to a lot of them. We validated and understood what really mattered for them. So then when we finally built it, like it just worked better the first time. Now there was tweaks, right? There were tweaks, but we got the overall blueprint, like I would say probably 90% right coming out of that discovery. And that's like, for me, that's the number one thing that separates a first-time entrepreneur from a repeat entrepreneur is they don't just jump right in. They test it very quickly. They do their discovery. And it makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah. There's still maybe a final gut call or instinct, yeah. But it's based on data at that point. It's based on tons and tons of feedback. Did you guys find that, you know, this system should work not only for Dreamit's kind of reconfiguration, but did you find that you were dealing with startups at a stage that could still benefit from this same model and implement it at the stage they were at?
That's funny, right? So earlier on, when we were in Dreamit 1.0, it was hugely valuable, right? We can go in there and be like, there's actually a really great story I tell a lot about a company that, and I'll tell you the short version of it. It was a company that had built the free features, but hadn't built their premium features. So they were like, okay, listen, we're going to spend the next 2 months building it, and then we'll have it. It'll be 2 weeks before demo day. We'll roll it out. We'll get the data, and we'll pitch. And then we're like, well, what happens if the data is not good? What happens if the conversion rate is too low? And they're like, oh, that would be bad. So we said, how about this, right? We're going to put up, or you're going to put up the upgrade now page, right? You know what you want to build. You know what you want to price it at. Just put it up there. And anyone who clicks it, you go, oh, coming soon. I even had one company that I did it. Their problem was they didn't have a merchant account. So they even took the credit card information. It never left the person's computer, but to them, it looked like he was actually purchasing it. And the reason it did it is it got them clean data on what the uptake rate was going to be from like free to premium. And they could do it in like an hour or two, right? They just put the page up. So then they did that. And next week they're back and like, yeah, we're screwed. Right? The rate's way too low.
Didn't work. Free conversion's high. Paid conversion is non-existent sometimes.
And it didn't work in such a dramatic way. There was no way they could tweak their way up to it. And then they kind of sheepishly said, but you know, this is one part of our site where like a lot of people are engaging. And we think we could build something different around this. You know, can we do that? And we're like, well, if this is a zero and that might not be a zero, sure, go ahead, do that, please. That's the whole idea. So they ended up doing it and it worked. And that company is now SeatGeek. So it's a billion-dollar company, a unicorn, that had they done the archetypical first founder, oh, let's just code it and see what happens, would never have existed.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I said it's ironic is because then when Dreamit went one stage later, most of the founders that we spoke to had either figured that out or already failed by doing it the other way. So that kind of impact would be less dramatic. But we did have, we had a saying internally, that we did and that we shared with our founders, right? Before you do anything, finish this sentence. This is a success if. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to go out there and you're going to test building a new feature, or you're going to test like a new marketing channel, how do you know it's a success? Drive it down to like a number you're going to measure or certain outcomes that you want. Because if you don't have that, you'll go do it. And then in 2 months, you'll come back and look at it. And you're like, wait, I don't really know what I proved here.
Yeah, I have data, but I'm not sure if it's good or
I don't know.
Or how to use it or how to make a decision from it.
Exactly. And then once you know, like, this is what success looks like, it sometimes leads you to think, well, do I really have to do all of this? Or is there a way I can do it much faster, much cheaper, maybe even for free, and get at the same number, and I don't have to do all of this? So it changes the mindset, and it just makes everything faster. And time kills startups. So you can do things faster and cheaper. You're just loading the dice.
Yeah.
You're just loading in your favor at every stage in the process.
Yeah, it really focuses the mind. I was telling my law firm staff just this morning about an experience where I, was talking about achieving something. And I said, but instead of just going out and doing it, what I did is I said to myself, I'm going to put a goal to it. So I wrapped it kind of like you're talking about. I wrapped it into this context. And I said, I'm just going to put a goal to it. And literally within 5 minutes of naming a goal instead of just an accomplishment, I started saying, oh, wait, why don't I do this? And my mind started connecting things that hadn't been connected before. And I'm like, there's real power in putting the right context around these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also, by the way, that's a whole about, I'm going to shift sideways a little bit and put my corporate hat on. So like we talked about the programs that we do with corporate, or when I do, like, I also do a lot of consulting for corporate innovation groups and corporate venture funds.
Okay.
I talk to them like, how you talk about something and how you measure it, like, you get what you measure, right? So one of the subtle mistakes they make is I'll ask, like, so how is that pilot coming along? And if you ask that question that way, the answer has to be, it's awesome. Right. They'll say, oh, that's awesome. No problem. And they'll start throwing more and more resources into making it a success until it is a success. But is it really a success if it took 9 months and, four times as much money as you thought? Or until they've been promoted and it's not their problem anymore? Whereas if you ask them instead, hey, how's the pilot coming along? Are they the right company for us to be working with? Or should we be looking somewhere else? Or is this the right approach? Or should we just, cut it and try something else. All of a sudden, iterating fast and getting to the answer is a win.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it changes how people think about it. It gives you permission to say, Andrew, we tried it. It looked great. Once we started working with them, those guys are impossible to work with. Let's go find somebody else.
Yeah. Like,
great. You figured that out in 3 months. Awesome. Let's go find somebody else.
You got to do that fast or you can't exist long enough to find success, right?
Well, large companies, because they have all their other strengths, they can drift on and they can do things slowly like that. It won't kill them usually, but it's even better for them. But the point I was trying to get at is just naming that goal and being very thoughtful about what that goal is, whether you're a startup, an individual, or even more so a large company, like, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess I was putting that back into the startup context of existing long enough to find success. But in the corporate setting, sometimes the most negative aspect is you can persist forever in the wrong direction, right?
Or you used to, right? One of the slides I give to the entrepreneurship class I give, I do one a year, is this chart. And it's the average time a Fortune 500 company, sorry, an S&P 500 company stayed in the S&P 500 index. And it went from being like on average 60 plus years Mm-hmm. Going down to about 11 years now. I mean, there are companies that have come out of left field and killed incumbents, like Netflix killing, Blockbuster.
Yeah.
Or Zipcar didn't quite kill a traditional, like, but they had to pay $7 billion to acquire it. And these are companies that came, as far as corporate was concerned, out of left field in a heartbeat, right? Before they even knew it, all of a sudden they were on top of them. So we're definitely in a point in time where, like, even if you're a large company and you can persist for a long time doing it, like, okay is getting progressively not okay.
And a long time is getting progressively shorter and shorter, isn't it?
Exactly.
Well, looking back at all of this and what you guys did to make these changes, how it's applied either in corporate or startup world, like, is there a part of it that people kind of consistently misunderstand? Like they like hear it and they're like, oh, I got this. And you're like, no, you don't. Like there's a real way to do this. And then there's this superficial, like, checkbox way to do this.
Yeah. Oh, I got this is exactly how my second startup went under. but that's not as interesting a story in this case. I'll tell you where it goes wrong in the corporate setting, right? So let's say, whatever reason you decided at a corporate, like, I need to do something. I want to set up a corporate venture fund, or I want to set up an accelerator. So you get these consultants in there and they create very paint by number versions of these things for you. Well, here's how the 20 other people do it. And here it is. We'll set this up. We'll do it. It'll be these months, these people, blah, 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 blah. And it turns what should be rapid iteration, figuring out what makes sense for your particular niche and your particular strengths, into a same old type exercise. And if most of these groups are mediocre, then you're going to get mediocre or worse, because the more people that do it, the harder it gets, more competition there is. So even what was good before is now average, and what was average before is now substandard.
Yeah.
So they end up, by trying to get kind of the best practices or whatever they want to call it, they end up guaranteeing that they're going to get something which is not going to perform well.
I mean, this is, I think you're describing what some people are saying is the real issue with, I mean, one of the real issues with AI, right? Like we're all using the same LLMs and getting to the same average faster, much, much faster, without necessarily thinking better.
So you gotta, I'll take writing. Like, I happen to like writing. I have to like writing. But there are a lot of people for whom writing is not their strongest suit. So for them, if they want to use an AI tool, I'm like, here's what I'm trying to say, can you clean it up for me? And that raises them up to, like, you know, a solid B+ piece of communication. That's awesome. It'll have a little bit of the sameness, a little bit of blandness, but it's better to have something that's a little kind of bland but does the job than something that's, like, you know, impossible to follow and poorly written. Mm-hmm. But if you want to really stand out, if you want to be great at something, it's not there. Which goes back to what we were saying before, like a team, eight players, right? Where do you need to be awesome? You may not need to be an awesome writer in your job. You may need to be just good enough. Like, my wife is a real estate agent. She needs to write descriptions of properties, right, in her listings. Does she need them to be, you know, like Milan Kundera level prose? Or does it just have to be like Hemingway simple? Right? That's fine. Hemingway simple is fine for what she does. She needs to be great at marketing herself, great at representing her clients. But just writing those descriptions, good enough is good enough.
Makes sense. Well, how is this trajectory that you've been on evolved you as a leader? And maybe to be more specific, are there things that in your past roles and functions maybe gave you a little more anxiety or even fear to face, that now looking back you're like, that doesn't happen anymore. I can deal with these things now because I've been there and seen it and done it.
You know, it's you do, but if you're really challenging yourself and you're living an interesting life, there will always be the conservation of uncertainty and fear. You've just moved up a level and you're learning and trying to learn new things. And that's great. Like I used to go back and I think about like, oh, where was I 5 years ago? I'm like, oh my God, like I thought I knew stuff, but man, was I clueless. And that used to bother me. Like, oh, I'm really embarrassed at like, you know, who I was 5 years ago. And then it occurred to me, the moment I wake up and ask, you know, 5 years ago, Andrew was, you know, was pretty spot on. He was not bad. That means I've learned nothing in 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
And that like scares the, you know, the bejesus out of me. So there were things that were tougher, right? Like, knowing how to manage up, knowing how to manage my workload, knowing how to communicate. Like you learn that with time. Doing cold calls, meeting people, like networking in general. You know, you can get better at that over time. But then you, again, you go up to the next level in the game. And now it's like, okay, I'm looking for these amorphous opportunities that, you know, maybe even the people who I'm talking to don't know exist because they didn't know they wanted it until I tell them about it.
Yeah.
Like, how do you find those people who have those latent needs? And like connect to them on that level to the point where they realize, oh yeah, I never knew that existed, but now I can't live without it.
That's interesting. It makes me want to flip the question because I think about a lot of our audience and people who are in the trenches right now, scared of everything and hustling as hard as they can to you know, overcome the things they're scared of. What's something in maybe generically, what's something that could be a trigger for them to indicate that, hey, if you are now dealing with a bigger problem or whatever, you don't actually need to continue to worry about the being scared about these things because you have progressed. Does that make sense?
So I'm going to do the traditional VC approach of answering something that may be vaguely related to your question, but I kind of find interesting and want to say anyway.
As an attorney, I fully accept that approach.
So here, Let me kind of put this out there for people who are stressed out startup founders.
Yeah.
You only have to be great at one thing. Everything else you have to be good enough at. So I see a lot of founders that come out there and they have a product and like this feature is a little better, that feature is a little better. And they think they're going to get like, oh, I have 20 features, they're all a little bit better. But the sum result of it is that it's much better. It's never going to work. It's never going to work. On the other hand, the startups where they do one thing that's a quantum level better than everything else and that no one else can do as well,
yeah,
their customers will live with a lot of mediocrity and everything else. It's like, that's awesome. I need to use it. I know it's not entirely built. I'll jerry-rig the rest of it. I'll download it as a CSV and I'll upload it somewhere else. I don't care, but I need that data.
Yeah.
So understand what you're awesome about. Make sure you deliver that. And then systematically make sure everything else is at least good enough. And you can always improve that other stuff later. But, you know, where you want to avoid is one of those things is not good enough and you can't sell it. Because I tell them also, like, startups like a chain. Every link has to work. It's not like a rope. You know, a couple of strands are frayed. The rope still holds. If one link is broken, then the entire chain is useless. But, like, they only have to be just strong enough. Right. If you got that one thing that matters, you just need everything else to be strong enough.
And you might not need a chain with 100 links in it either for a startup, right? You might need a chain with...
Yeah, if no one cares about, you know, that, just don't build it. Yeah.
Build it with a dozen links instead of 100. I think that's where I see this in the, you know, legal tech is booming right now and everything is AI based. It's like, I see these startups and I'm like, that's a startup? Like that one, like I'm dealing with, like literally I've built a fractional legal team so we can take attorneys and plug them in and cover all the issues that happen in a startup company, which is amazingly diverse number of issues, as we all know. Yeah. But then I see a startup pop up and it's like, oh, they deal with one employment law issue from one perspective and they're raising money and killing it. And I'm like, well, I mean, to put it in your analogy, they must have the right emphasis and the right strength, enough strength on enough links that it's addressing a problem people are willing to pay for.
So we look at it with like these two, you know, is it a company or is it a feature, right? Because at some point, if you just do that and it's like, so just that one thing, but then it stands alone, doesn't work in the workflow, eventually it's going to get sucked in.
Sure.
But eventually someone's going to say, listen, like that's a little better at it. But this is good enough and it works with everything else. So I'm just going to do the all-in-one. The other danger for companies like that is market size.
Yeah. Like,
how big can they be? If they're not big enough, then we got to pass, even if they are solving a very targeted pain point. And that founder may make a lot of money. He just won't get VC backing usually if it's too narrow and the market size is small.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, we're watching all these weird dynamics play out and a lot of emphasis on a lot of things that are AI based. So there's kind of sometimes a business model behind the business model too, I think. So it'll be interesting to see where it all lands.
Since it's early stages, I bet you the conversation goes something like this. You know, hey, we're solving this one problem. Here's our vision slide with the other five problems that we're going to solve.
Yep.
And ultimately, we're going to be the entire CRM or the entire, you know, ERP system for law firms everywhere.
Sure. Right?
But we're going to own this. We're going to expand to here. These guys are going to be small. We'll buy that and we'll plug it in. They all want to be that backbone. And these are all their wedge products.
Yep.
Because it's early in the game for this.
Yeah.
That's probably how those dynamics play out.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure you're right with that. Well, this has been fantastic, and I appreciate you sharing your insights with us. What's the top takeaway that, you know, if you were looking back at other startups, or maybe even, you know, younger Andrew who's entering the world in the context that we're in today, what would you say as that advice to somebody getting into this chaotic world?
You know, I'm smiling. I'm about to give like entirely self-serving advice, sincere totally but self-serving.
Yeah.
The number one thing I would say is like, listen, you got to go buy this book. Everything you need is in this book, The Entrepreneur's Odyssey. It's like everything we've talked about and more. It's all in this book and it's not boring as fuck. Sorry. So yeah, a little self-serving, but that's the whole point. Like I wrote this thing because these were the conversations I was having in and out, day in, day out, with all these companies I was coaching in the accelerator, with the other companies I was mentoring. And I said, you know what? Like, we're going to write it all down. And we're not just going to write it all down like, here's your how-to guide. We're going to write it like that story I told you before about SeatGeek. We're going to write it about a startup that they can identify with, in this case, a fictional startup. Take them through every step in the process so they can learn it all in a memorable and hopefully entertaining way. So yeah, that's the advice I would give myself if the book existed when I was younger. Your and audience is in luck because it exists now.
And where can they find that if they're looking for that book?
Oh, I was afraid you'd never ask. Everything's on Amazon. It's The Entrepreneur's Odyssey. I don't think there's any other book called that. If there is, it's the one by Andrew Ackerman with this very cool cover. Don't accept any substitutes. Or if you're kind of like, well, that guy was vaguely interesting, I want to hear more. You can go to my website. It's Andrew, the letter B as in boy, Ackerman.com. A little bit more about me. And shockingly, also links to where you can buy the book.
Awesome. Very cool. The only other thing I'd say is it Matt Damon coming out with the movie right now, The Odyssey? You know, if you get a chance.
That's a little different.
Throw his picture on there, right?
Maybe I should get a blurb from him. It's not too late.
That's right. Yeah. Well, Andrew, thank you for coming on the show. Our audience needs a lot of these insights. They need what's in that book. I'm sure of it. And it's anything that we can do, you and I and the other guests that we have on here, to help build some confidence, get them through some of their struggles. It's a win from our end, I think. So I really appreciate what you've shared.
Yeah, listen, I learned things the hard way. Learn from other people's mistakes. It's so much more pleasant.
Yes. And with that, thank you to all of our listeners. Thanks for joining us on the Breakout CEO podcast again. We'll see you next week. Be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you enjoy the show, a rating or a review goes a long way. Our mission is to promote the stories of breakout CEOs in scaling SaaS, e-commerce, and tech companies to equip peer CEOs with valuable perspectives and confidence. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of The Breakout CEO. I'm Jeff Holman, and I'll see you next time.